There's some brain rot levels of cuteness for you with Tian Tian De by Jay Cho, which means sweetness. Here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM, I'm Leslie. It's a huge emotional whiplash compared to that previous song that we heard by Jackie Jung, who's literally like, my heart is in pain because you will not respond to me. Do you even love me? I guess only the stars can be my companion tonight. Whereas Jay Cho is like, I love my girlfriend. She's so cute. I'm gonna sing a song about her. There's a part where he basically starts to go like, every time we touch, I get this feeling. He's like, every time we kiss, it's like, psh. Oh, no, there is that lyric in Cascadia, right? Because every time we touch, I get this feeling. Every time we kiss, I swear I could fly. Yeah, he kind of does something similar, except it's, you know, it's like incredibly brain rot cute. Did I mention my name already? It's Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Been talking about Dream Factory, Canto Pop, and Mando Pop of the 1980s to 2000s, an exhibition that is still running over at the Chinese Canadian Museum in Chinatown. It's gonna be there until August 23rd. That's the last day, so do consider checking it out. It is very cool, in my opinion. This exhibition is really focused on Canto Pop and Mando Pop and its impact on diaspora, particularly in Vancouver. And it also discusses the success of these music industries during that era in a really interesting way. One of my critiques of this exhibition is that I wish that it would talk a little bit more about the cultural influences of Canto Pop and Mando Pop and modern Chinese language music. Like, there's, you know, this like timeline in the exhibition, and it starts in the 1920s with Shanghai jazz, but like Shanghai jazz came from somewhere, right? It was like Shanghai jazz was like heavily, heavily, heavily influenced by not only European imperialism in Shanghai, but more specifically and more importantly, Black American jazz musicians who like performed in Shanghai in the 1920s. And it did, like, you know, this exhibition doesn't make a whole lot of mention either around the influence of J-pop and Britpop on Cantopop, which was really, really surprising, actually. But I understand, because, you know, that's not the point of the exhibition. The point is to talk about how these industries have impacted their audience in contexts like in Vancouver. And I think one of the things we have to really understand here is why that era is called the golden era of Canto Pop and Mando Pop, the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s. That is the time when you had a lot of folks immigrating out of Hong Kong out of Taiwan, and later, a little bit later on, you know, towards the end of that era, more people emigrating out of China who would settle in places like Vancouver, working and also raising families. The 1980s to the 2000s is kind of like the prime time for a lot of these people and their children to really yearn for a home. And music and film are those things that, you know, are quite a bit more accessible for people to have a pathway to stay connected to home. I know certainly that was the case for my family. Without getting into too much personal information, my older sibling was born in the early 80s. My family came to Canada in the 90s. And it was through, you know, music and film that my older sibling stayed in touch with, essentially, like, you know, youth culture and popular culture from back home. You know, they collected like photo cards and like bromides of Hong Kong pop idols, for example. They had like a binder full of them, full of these photos. They would like buy albums whenever they could, like whenever they had like some spare pocket change, or they like saw a store that like had the latest album that they wanted. It was largely the reason why they learned how to use the internet, was to download music and movies from Hong Kong, Taiwan, China to watch and to like bond over with their friends, who were also diaspora kids in large part. And so reflecting on this, I couldn't help but to kind of like sit with some complicated thoughts about how people think about Asian popular music now. I mean, in specifically East Asian, Southeast Asian popular music. Now, I've discussed on Typically Tuesdays before that it's kind of fascinating how the success of East Asian popular music, and I focus on East Asian popular music because I'm not as familiar with Southeast Asian pop music and pop music of many other places of the world, very frankly. But it's very interesting how global success is measured on the validation and recognition of these industries and their performers by essentially Western and white American audiences, rather than the impact on the diasporas and also on viewers from countries that are not like located in the countries that are not the United States, countries that are not located in Western Europe. The exhibition makes it explicit, like very, very, very clear that one of the reasons why you can call the 1980s to the 2000s the golden era of Cantopop and Mandopop is in great part because these performers had a lot of success throughout East and Southeast Asia, right? Almost every time that Teresa Tung is mentioned in Dream Factory, there is also a highlighting of like her audience in Japan, and the fact that she recorded albums in Bahasa, like recorded albums for Singaporean and Malaysian audiences. Before you enter the actual exhibition itself, there's a coffee table that has research materials that the curators consulted as they were putting the exhibition together. And some of these materials aren't in English nor in Chinese. They're actually in Japanese. These are materials about Cantopop and Mandopop in Japanese. I even flipped through this photo book of Leslie Jung that was produced and published by a Japanese publishing house. Like, this is the extent of their reach at that time. These performers had incredibly dedicated fandoms throughout East and Southeast Asia, and dedicated fandoms within the diasporas as well. Yes, they were recognized at certain times by white North Americans, essentially. For example, Leslie Jung was the representative of the Hong Kong Pavilion during the 86 Expo in Vancouver. That was one of the... It was the through that event that partly led to him deciding to settle in Vancouver. But that was also not an audience that he necessarily had to rely on in order to become successful and in order to become recognized in many other places outside of Hong Kong, right? Outside of Chinese-speaking countries. Now, obviously, I don't really know what the tensions of this particular type of discussion around, like, global recognition and things like that were back then. I was but a twinkle in my parents' eye, or whatever that saying is. But, you know, this topic is so nuanced and fascinating to me because, you know, when we think about, like, what the modern, like, our contemporary kind of, like, examples of popular forms of Asian music that are achieving global recognition are, you know, K-pop, to some extent, J-pop, to some extent, P-pop. I would not necessarily put C-pop in there. I don't even think that C-pop is an appropriate name to use, because there's clearly Cantopop and Mandopop. I'm sorry. But I find that, like, conversation very interesting. On one hand, you have people who insist that these music genres, which even when we talk about when we talk about Korean, Japanese, you know, Filipino, etc., etc., like pop music, like we can't just lump it all under the category of K-pop or J-pop or whatever. We can't. Like, there are nuances in there, but they're insistent that they should be judged on the standard and levels of, like, English language American music, right? There's been this whole conversation about the new, was it, like, Best Asian Album Award or something like that, that the Grammys have created recently. And whether or not creating this specific category excludes acts that would come from K-pop or J-pop or P-pop and whatever, from being considered for categories like Best Album of the Year. Because it specifies and in some ways tokenizes Asian music and music from East and Southeast Asia. Again, you know, go back to the episodes and the archives where I talk about the complications of, like, the category of Asian and all that, for more, because okay, Asian music and two, possibly three countries represent the entire Asian continent. Okay, sure, whatever. Specifically, apparently, in the description for the Grammys for that particular award, it makes mention of K-pop, J-pop, and C-pop. Apparently. complicated. So there's like that whole discussion there, right? Where folks are really insistent that that category shouldn't exist at all. It creates grounds for exclusion, etc. And I really understand those concerns. I do also think that it is just a little bit more complicated than that. Because on one hand, you do have producers of those industries who have been very insistent that, you know, for example, K-pop is its own very specific, distinguished music category on its own. Like, producers of that industry who are Korean. And I'm not just talking about music producers. I'm talking about the producers of the entire industry, like CEOs of those management companies, CEOs of those entertainment companies insisting that. And wanting to essentially hold on to that, like, distinct cultural and national identifier for the sake of, like, cultural and national pride, often as a direct response to Western and American cultural imperialism and hegemony. And my question is always going to be, why must we insist that American institutions need to specifically recognize these industries, these performers, in order for these industries and performers to be considered legitimate? The obvious reason is imperialism, American cultural imperialism, no doubt about it. I challenge also the notion that we have to always go by these standards in order to feel as though these albums, these performers, these industries have attained wide global success. Because I don't think it's realistic. It also holds up American hegemony, obviously. But there is, as displayed, I think, by Dream Factory and as discussed by Dream Factory, there is a lot of power in the diasporic fandoms already. And as many people are becoming more open-minded about consuming cultural products, participating in fandom of different cultures and different countries, I don't know that we always have to rely on American cultural institutions to recognize a non-American performer's success in order for them to be considered internationally or globally successful. I really do think that fandoms around the world already speak for themselves a lot of the times. If we're looking at numbers specifically, like I said, like, BTS has it in the bag. Even if they don't get that award, like, their sales on that album are bananas, right? Like, they do not need to be given, like, a small statue in order to be understood as legitimate. And I think, like, we really put limits on ourselves about how expansive art and music and entertainment can be if we insist on these Western and American institutions to be the judges of what good cultural products are, what good music are, what good films are, and so on, right? There is a reason why, like, just to be very frank, right? There is a reason why this Best Asian Album, Best Asian Artist, or whatever award will exist. And it is to specifically, one, uphold American cultural hegemony and imperialism, and two, continue to legitimize these Western and American institutions, to not consider the true facts, which is that these industries will exist successfully beyond like a Grammy Award. They will be successful beyond being considered for Best Album of the Year. In great part, diaspora really impacts that success, diasporic fandoms, as we see in Dream Factory. But as we also see in Dream Factory, it isn't always just about the diaspora, right? It is also just about, like, people's interest in that music, in those musicians in general, from other places in the world. And I think it's really imperative for people who are living in diaspora to do this specifically, to, like, imagine other ways to legitimize the global and international success of whatever of our favorite musicians from back home, or even favorite musicians of, you know, a shared parallel culture, right? Like, this is not something that will be explored, but, like, for example, like, the development of, like, a Pan-Asian identity for many people who may be participating in fandoms and consuming cultural products from many parts of Asia that aren't limited to their country or culture of origin, or even, like, the parallels that run between being a diaspora kid and, in some ways, in some circumstances, and I would say the majority of circumstances, being a perpetual foreigner in a place where people will not really recognize you as being, you know, a person that they can accept and call one of their own 100%, and the perpetual foreignness of being a musician or performer being recognized by an American cultural institution that doesn't even want you there. But again, this particular topic is not as clean cut as a lot of people present it to be, and not as clean cut as even I have presented it to be, even though I have tried to present, like, a few more nuances in there. Something to think about, perhaps. Hey, if you are a diaspora kid of any diaspora, any cultural diaspora, can you tell me about the musicians who your family really likes, and musicians that you really like from your country of roots? Tell me what songs I should play of theirs and what songs I should check out of theirs. You can text me those things, 778-782-2573. You can also email them to me at typicallytuesdays@gmail.com. And I'd be really excited to know. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Typically Tuesdays. It's a little bit unwieldy, I think, but I hope I piqued your interest to check out Dream Factory at the Chinese Canadian Museum. Again, it's currently running, and it's only got a few more weeks left. It's closing on August 23rd. This interactive, immersive experience is really entertaining, educational, and it will put some bangers on your music rotation. So do consider checking it out. Tune into more great CJSF programming. Check out Bitcoover every Tuesday from 8 to 10 in the evening here on 90.1 FM, where DJ Lately plays chiptune music and video game music. It's a really fun time. Also, he plays like electronic music if it's not like specifically like from like a video game or anything like that. Yeah, it's a really good time. Tuesdays from 8 to 10 here on 90.1 FM, or stream us online, cjsf.ca. Let me close off today's program with a bit of one final song. I heard this track the first time at Dream Factory, at those little listening stations. And I really, really enjoyed it. I hope you will as well. Finally, a song that's a little bit more upbeat. Even though it's kind of sad, just bear with it. It's called Lonely by Grasshopper, and I hope you will enjoy it as much as I do. I've been Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM, and I will talk to you again very soon.
在千道场，胡乱碰撞一千次，一亿次。